Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the value of a great conversation with somebody we hardly know? Whether we've chatted away the time on a long plane flight or made a new friend at a cocktail party, we have all experienced the beauties and blunders of communicating with a new person. And while we usually have no particular agenda in those talks, they can reveal a great deal about the people engaged in them. My guest today adores good conversations, and his new book probes the patterns they follow and the little things that separate a forgettable chat from one that is truly memorable. Daniel Menaker is a writer and literary editor. His new book is called A Good Talk, The Story and Skill of Conversation. Mr. Menaker, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here. And call me Dan.
Thank you. Call me Chris. You make a connection here between respect for a good conversation and respect for something like slow food or grassroots politics. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's interesting that you picked that out, and I appreciate it. I think that in a speeded-up world, which we definitely are living in, there are all kinds of temptations to do everything quickly. And so there are various kinds of protests and even movements to try to restore some sense of decent pace to our lives. One of them is slow food. One of them is... one of them is conversation. I think that we text, we email, we even talk on the phone, although this is a very generous amount of time, I have to say. And we do have to do everything quickly. A worsening economy doesn't help because people are benighted by their economic circumstances. So I think there's a kind of almost ecological reason to try to restore a certain sense of civility and leisurely communication between people.
And your interest here is specifically in extended conversations we have with people we don't know all that well. What makes them so different from the heart-to-hearts we might have with an old friend?
Well, I think when you're with an old friend, you can start right in. Mm-hmm. You can say, you know what, my husband is really giving me a pain in the neck. If you say that to a stranger, he or she may be somewhat taken aback. Mm-hmm. But you have a whole history with a good friend. You don't need the sort of rituals and protocols of greeting and of getting to know you, because you know each other. And if you need to, and if there's a crisis or a joy or something that's immediately on your mind, that's what good friends are for. You can skip the formalities.
You know, it struck me in reading the book that the difference between a conversation with an acquaintance and someone we know very well accounts in some ways for the changes in relationships over time. You can have a great conversation with your spouse after a decade, but it's never going to feel like that first time you closed down a restaurant.
No, I think that, as I do say in the book, that there are times of life for the really long marathon conversations and the deeper, you know, more intimate connections that you can make by talking to somebody. They kind of diminish over time, although one hopes they don't disappear entirely. And also, the economic pressures, again, I think, you know, mitigate against being able to just have a good, luxurious talk with somebody else.
It's interesting, though. Sometimes we've got the time, but I know people who would rather fly in the baggage compartment than talk to the person next to them on an airplane. What are we afraid of?
Airplane's a special place, and and we're learning that anew every day in dire ways and in ordinary ways. I think it's a special space. It's up in the air. There are quite a few people who are anxious about flying. And I think there's a kind of a common agreement that you leave each other alone pretty much when your seatmates, you're thrown together, unless you both give the correct signals that it's okay to talk. But it really has to be two consenting adults.
You've said you'd like to have a sticker or something so you can indicate whether you're in the mood to talk or not.
Yeah, I was thinking a green dot, like an Indian caste mark on the forehead, would be good for, yes, I can talk about your trip to Vienna last year, and a yellow dot for maybe, let's find out, and a red dot for please don't talk to me. I don't think there's anything rude about not wanting to talk on an airplane. In fact, I think the rudeness comes when someone sitting next to you presumes that you are all too willing to have a conversation.
You call this aimless talk, meaning we don't have an agenda, it's not a business meeting, we're not planning the PTA fundraiser, but there is still a value to it.
Yes, and in some ways it's a misnomer. I mean, I kind of make the point that these kinds of conversations, the ones that I'm most interested in or the ones that I've thought about and read about the most, are without an agenda. They're not a business meeting. They're not a college interview. They're not a merger discussion. You know, they're not asking for directions or recipes or anything. But there is ultimately a purpose for all human communication, and it's bred into our genes. It's an evolutionary necessity to have a social fabric in which people communicate with each other, even if it's about things that have no particular goal or purpose. They do have the purpose of bringing us together, and that seems to be a necessity. You can see that in the, as I say in the book, in the very impoverished places, which are so shameful to us and so upsetting, because one of the very first things to go under such circumstances is conversation.
It is, in some ways, a luxury. You have to be comfortable and safe before you can do this.
I wouldn't say it's a luxury. I've used that word already in our conversation, but let me retract it a little bit. I think, and it's not an indulgence, I actually think, I mean, from what I know and anecdotally in my own circles and what I've seen and where I've traveled, that everybody needs to communicate with one another. I think it is a primary human need. It's true, there are odd individuals who are isolated and want solitude, and I am not mean to disparage or criticize them, but for the great majority of human lives, I think that this is not really an indulgence, but a necessity.
So how did we evolve from politely delousing each other as lower primates to politely chatting up strangers at dinner parties?
Well, we don't really know for sure. There are two or three kinds of theories about it, but the main thesis seems to be that as we had certain genetic mutations, especially in a certain gene called the FOX2P gene, and also as fossil evidence shows that our larynxes, that primate larynxes shifted position in some way that that I don't understand. In fact, I'm having a little trouble with my larynx right now. Hold on one sec.
Sure.
That they migrated in a way that began to allow us to form specific sounds, vowel sounds and consonant sounds. And as we lived in tribes, I mean, the speech facility was probably grew out of very animal-like noises, like grunts, moans of ecstasy, possible warning signals and so on. And I think that what happened was that warnings and naming probably coalesced first. That's what most experts seem to think. And that later, this new tool was put to new uses and expanded very rapidly. And it only started about 50,000 years ago, by the way.
You went back to look at the history of conversation, at least since we've been fully human, and Socrates tends to get a lot of the credit here. But it turns out we don't have much to indicate that he spent any time in aimless discussion.
Right. And first of all, I mean, what's interesting about the history of conversation is sort of like that it's the history of air. I mean, you can't literally, and in a kind of specific way and in an amusing way, you can't write down the history of conversation. It defies historians, but they still try. That's fine. Socrates, I think, blazed many kinds of trails and perhaps in some ways conversational, but he was an iconoclast. He was a doubter, a skeptic, and he conducted most of the famous dialogues that Plato recorded as interrogations or almost cross-examinations, trying to show people who were sure of themselves, especially leaders in Athens who thought they had the truth, that maybe they shouldn't be quite so comfortable in the received opinions. For this, he was ultimately branded a kind of revolutionary and was condemned to death.
He does strike you, though, as someone who was probably a very good listener.
Well, I think he was a superb listener, but he was a superb listener in the way that a prosecuting attorney is a superb listener to a witness. That is to say, almost everything we know of him in terms of what we believe to be his conversations had a goal of proving a point. And that's not necessarily what we want to do when we talk to each other. However, he was a terrific, he was curious, and he did ask very telling questions. And I think in some ways it can be said that the idea of debating started for the Western world with his dialogues.
So moving on to Cicero, he sort of elucidated some guidelines that, still apply today.
Cicero wrote a beautiful essay called De Officiis, which means about duties or about responsibilities, basically. And a significant part of it he devoted to some very basic rules of conversation. And they're the first ones that we have, as far as I know, and as far as most experts agree, of a sort of setting down of certain guidelines and parameters for talking to each other, and they still make sense today. He, I think, laid the groundwork for later essays in the Renaissance, when the classics were rediscovered, especially in Italy, for new codes of conduct for conversation. But he was an amazing writer, and in his letters you can hear what kind of conversationalist he must have been.
So we'll fast forward here to the London coffee houses, which established, I think, some fascinating rules of engagement for the conversations that took place there.
Well, what's interesting is that so much commerce grew out of London coffee house conversations, and so much politics did, because in a way some of those rules were against that. I mean, the point of those coffee houses was to engage in, yes, arguments, but also conversations, exchanges of information that were supposed to be part of leisure life. In fact, they were the one of the main coffee houses grew into Lloyd's of London, the great insurance company, if I have that right. And so it was a culture that encouraged people to get together, sit down, have a cup of this new brew called coffee, and shoot the breeze. And at first, women were excluded from coffee houses. Later on, because of David Hume, the philosopher, who crowned women the sovereigns of conversation, they were admitted. But at first it was an exclusively male occupation, which is weird, because I think if I were in Las Vegas and had to bet on who makes better conversationalists, men or women, I would say women, sadly.
Why do you think that's the case?
I don't know. I don't want to be sexist, but there are neurological and MRI studies that show that men in their sort of mental reactions and brain processes tend to be more linear and more direct and more about sort of proving points or establishing directions or truth. And women tend to understand, I think, a little bit better the social necessities of conversation, the more grooming-like activities. They're both essential ingredients of conversation. And when men and women speak together and when they make connections, whether it's personal and romantic or simply social, it's a wonderful kind of harmony. Sometimes it's a conflict, as Deborah Tannen tells us in Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus.
Daniel Menaker is my guest. His new book is called A Good Talk, The Story and Skill of Conversation. We'll resume the conversation in just a moment, and you're welcome to join it by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer and literary editor Daniel Menaker. His new book is called A Good Talk, The Story and Skill of Conversation. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. David Hume also recognized the value of impudence in conversation. And your take on the word is that it's not so much about rudeness as it is an expression of nerve.
That's right. And I think that most of us, if we're not too hidebound and rigid in our personalities, respond well to a bit of conversational nerve that others may bring to us, and others will respond well, too. I think a lot of us, I don't believe in rudeness, and I don't believe in sarcasm, but I do think that sometimes you can begin to deepen a conversation, oddly enough, by being a little provocative or saying something that's a little impish, let's put it that way, so that, you know, to recognize that this is a form of play as well as a form of communication. And I want, may I just back up for 1 second?
Sure.
To the previous conversation? I'm just curious, this the difference between men and women that we discussed briefly, or that I tried to somehow fake my way through, I wonder if you share that opinion, because of course it's a very controversial one and people have berated me for it, so I'm kind of curious in a way.
Well, I think there is a difference. I was struck, I think you write in the book that men talk about themselves twice as much as women do in any particular conversation. It does seem that women are sensitive to what the other person is thinking to a greater extent than men. And now, watch the phone lines light up. And of course, there are exceptions to that.
Well,
but I think that women are from the beginning really good at reading other people.
Yeah.
And I think it's a skill that men have to work a little harder to develop.
No, I agree, and I think that there's something that women sort of can learn from men also. And in other words, in both cases, it's an asset that either gender can help to incorporate from the other.
Yeah. Let's talk for a minute about how you settle on the tone for a particular conversation, because you can have a conversation with a stranger that's pretty jocular or one that's pretty solemn.
Well, I think you just, this 2 seconds ago, discussed being sensitive to the nature of the other person. And I think we have an orchestra inside us if we're socially skilled. And if we're not, we can learn to play those instruments. And there are all kinds of instruments that you can choose from. And I mean, I'm answering your question by sort of not answering it. But I think you have to kind of be able to judge what is called for. And maybe the way to answer the question is to say this. We all know people who can't make those adjustments,
mm-hmm.
who have only one instrument to play. It can be a perfectly pleasing one, but it also can be a monotonous one. Or it can be, unfortunately, more likely, an arrogant or overbearing or uninterested one in which the person is simply holds forth rather than listens to. So I think, you know, you have to... We have different kinds of selves, and all of them are valid, and I think we have to kind of feel each other out when we first meet what part of myself is going to work with this person. And that other person should be thinking the same thing. You'll arrive at common ground, unless there's pathology involved. We have a remarkable ability to get along when we put our minds to it.
Well, I love this examination you have of how we initially feel each other out. When you sit down next to somebody, you don't know their politics, you don't know their family background, you may not know anything about them, and you have to sort of toss things that are pretty safe out there and see how they're received.
Yeah, I think that the safety feature at the beginning of a conversation is very important, and I think that's one reason that there are greeting rituals in every society, and there are different ones in different geographical areas, but in all cases, they represent conventions. And some people who are perhaps more rebellious or think they're more colorful will try to jump ahead of those conventions and not say, how are you, and not say, it's good to meet you, and even it's a nice day, which I understand it's not in Dallas particularly.
It's a little rainy, but it's been really cold, so we're not complaining.
Okay. There are people who feel that those kinds of formalities should be just disregarded, but problem with that is that, you know, shaking hands, as I say in the book, was a way of showing that you were not armed. And there is an evolutionary reason for us to be wary of strangers. It doesn't really obtain much anymore, except when it does. That is to say, they could be aggressive, they could be hostile, they could be from another tribe. We didn't know. So in order to signal in a kind of ancient way that we mean no harm and that we are feeling in a friendly way, we have these set rituals of greeting. And I think what happens is that we give each other signals, both verbally and physically, that we are willing to sit down or hang around and have a conversation. And little by little, the depth develops, and people begin to take slight risks. They begin to divulge more about their personal history, about their occupation. They may even begin to, you know, complain about a physical ailment or open themselves in a more vulnerable way. So it's a very slow dance. Not very slow, but it's a dance that we both people have to sort of be in step with each other.
What's really unique about a conversation with someone that you don't know well and in certain circumstances may never see again is that there are times when you can open up to a person like that in a way that you wouldn't to your best friend.
And, yeah, I'm just wondering about that. It depends on what kind of best friend you have. I have a best friend to whom I think I would say just about anything, and he would tolerate it and not question the value of our friendship, even if it was atrocious. And I think he feels the same way. Although I have to say, sometimes I have to say, okay, I've given you three sort of self-damning things. Would you please give me one back? Because he'll sit there sometimes like a stone. But I trust him completely. I trust his advice. But you're absolutely right. You find yourself in an airport lounge with a stranger. The thing is that there are going to be no consequences to divulging things to that person. And you see the George Clooney movie Up in the Air, and you find out how true this is. But in a way, they're also so transient that even though they feel like a catharsis, they don't really go anywhere, and you feel unburdened maybe, but it doesn't develop. So I'd say do that whenever you feel safe. It's increasingly difficult in an electronic world because of, God help us, you know, surveillance cameras and texting and GPSs and so on and so forth. But keep your friends.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're speaking this hour with Daniel Menaker, whose new book is called A Good Talk, The Story and Skill of Conversation. We'll turn to the phones now and speak first with Maggie in Fort Worth. Hi, Maggie.
Hello.
Hi.
I spent a lot of years as a park ranger, an interpretive naturalist in the Park Service, where they teach you don't memorize your tour. Have the information at hand and speak extemporaneously. And I find that a really interesting kind of conversation with strangers where they come to you, but you don't need to just spoon-feed the information. You can learn a lot from their signals and their questions, and they will share a lot with you. And I'm just wondering if you have looked at that kind of conversation.
I've lived it, and I think most of us who have occupations that require communication know that it's a good idea to have the facts and the nature of the information you're supposed to give, let's say at a sales conference, take another example, have it ready at hand, but be also ready to adjust the way you say it depending on what kind of circumstance you find yourself in. And depending, I guess, in the case of a ranger, on the nature of the group or the person that you're talking to. There must be children from time to time. You need to adjust for that. There may be older people, again, an adjustment. There may be people who want to be faster about the tour or slower. So, I mean, really, professional presentations, except when they're speeches or PowerPoint presentations, ought to be pretty flexible, I think, and I think that people who are better at that generally, you know, are promoted. I mean, that kind of resilience and sort of spontaneity is a very important factor in any kind of occupation that requires talking.
And spontaneity works for, again, listening as much as it does talking. You write about the dropped handkerchiefs of good conversations, and these are little clues that people offer about themselves and their characters, and we can choose to either pick them up or leave them where they lie.
I think that modern talking therapy is based, to a large extent, on Freud's and other people's belief that we often tell more about ourselves in the parentheses than we do in the main parts of the sentence. And I think that those parentheses are the dropped handkerchiefs, that someone will sometimes rush over something that involves a conflict or a difficulty or even a matter of pride out of modesty. And I think it's a real service to somebody, without becoming too much of a snoop or prodding or turning into a psychoanalyst in front of their eyes, to say, hey, wait a minute. You said that, you know, you'd run the marathon in, what, 3.5 hours? They may have just dropped that as a handkerchief to say why they hadn't been available that day. And then, you know, it's fun to pick up the handkerchief and say, that's amazing. 3.5 hours, that's close to world class. And then they modestly blush and say, well, you know, I didn't mean to brag. And they say, you should. And so that's the kind of attention to small details that can really deepen a conversation, because those things in the corners are often the important things.
Even if we have to interrupt what they've moved on to say to bring them back to the marathon that they ran.
Yeah, I mean, yes, as I think I did, you know, earlier in this part of our conversation, mm-hmm. I wanted to go back to some other thing that we talked about before. And I think, and I also think it's a compliment to be that attentive. I mean, you don't have to be, like, you know, intense and rigid and like on, you're not on trial, but but if you remember something that somebody said from earlier and sort of put it together with your own thoughts or something else, it shows that you're there, you're engaged, you're listening, and you're curious.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We will go next to Corsicana and speak with Laura. Hi, Laura.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
You know, I appreciate your guest's appreciation of those lateral side trips, but I wonder if he would address the resentment that is often engendered in men when women are direct, do make their points, and do logically prove those points via linear connections.
I think that insofar as that is true, and I fear that it is truer than I want to believe, that it shows a certain kind of gender limitation in men. We are in the process of becoming a global world, and we are in the process of needing the talents and the sort of good faith and goodwill of everybody who has those qualities. And I think that if a man is threatened by a woman, I think that's really what we're talking about here, because he may feel it's a gender role that he has to be the direct and clear one, and that a woman acts supposedly, quote, like a man, unquote, it's some kind of, you know, they're not being feminine enough. I don't know what to say. I think they need to go into therapy. I think they need to get over themselves. We need to get over ourselves and simply accept that any gender can have the solution to a problem, and we don't have to know everything or be the authority on everything. I think it's a real challenge, and I think it's an excellent question.
Is there always an undercurrent of sexuality in conversations between people who might be attracted to each other in different circumstances?
You've answered your own question by saying people who might be attracted to each other. I think the answer is yes. I think, you know, there's a cliche, love makes the world go round. And to some extent in conversation, I think between a man and a woman, and between gay people who are in any way plausible potential partners, depending on the mores and morals of the situation, I think there is an undercurrent of attraction. And, you know, conversation, the word, was in the 19th and 18th centuries a euphemism for intercourse. And I think there's a reason for that. Many people will tell you, and perhaps more women than men, but I'm not sure, that a really good conversation with someone that you may be falling in love with is on a par with physical intimacy. And I believe that to be true.
Well, it's interesting as well because, I mean, I'm heterosexual, but I have women friends with whom you just instantly have a chemistry, not sexual chemistry, but there are other people you can have a decent conversation with, but you don't click in the same way.
I think that's right, and I think that chemistry is indeed, you know, not just a metaphor in this case, because we're evidently very sensitive to pheromones, the physical effects of body language, we're attracted to different physical aspects of people, even if it's not sexual. We just like to be in their company because they look a certain way that we find appealing. I think chemistry matters. I also think it's very important to try not to restrict oneself to those chemical reactions, but to find stuff in other people to whom we may not be initially attracted that may end up being attractive. But there are people who can be on perfectly civil terms with each other who simply don't have that magnetism that you're talking about.
One of my favorite sections of the book is where you talk about, you know, the walls we run into in conversations and your suggestion that if you can't think of anything else to talk about, ask somebody about the people in their lives with whom they no longer communicate.
Well, it's a paradox because it's a conversation suggestion about not talking to people. But I've found, you know, it's funny because there's almost a numerical standard here. I found that first of all, it always engages somebody, and I don't care. I mean, of course, someone might be offended or say, what a rude question, but then too bad. You just, you know, apologize and try to move on or move away, maybe. But, I think that almost everyone has two or three people to whom they don't speak, and if it's more than five people, then they may have some paranoid problems.
Daniel Menaker is my guest. His new book is called A Good Talk, The Story and Skill of Conversation. We'll be back in a couple of minutes, and you can join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Daniel Menaker. He's a writer and literary editor whose new book is called A Good Talk, The Story and Skill of Conversation. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. Dan, we have an astounding number of opportunities these days to listen to other people's conversations on radio and TV, shows like this one, for example. Does listening in that way have any resemblance to a real conversation for the third party who is not directly involved?
Well, as a wishy-washy liberal, I'll say yes and no. I think that those conversations, and I make an exception, and I'm not just flattering you, Chris, but I'll make an exception for this one. First of all, I'm very flattered that you seem to have read the book so carefully. It's not always the case. Questions are very well formed. It's still an interview, not really a conversation, but I think you can tell, as I feel now, when you hear interviews and talk radio and talk television, you can hear receptiveness on the part of the interviewer, and you can feel that you are taking part or listening to something resembling a conversation rather than a strict interrogation. But for the most part, the answer to your question is no. I don't think they're conversations. I think you can learn from them. I think Bill Moyers on PBS is a good example of a more spontaneous and open-minded interlocutor. But I think they're helpful. I think they're informative. I think you can kind of navigate the world partly on the basis of what you learn from such conversational shows. But far too many of them are simply forums for ranting and for opinionated and closed-minded repetitions of the same points, or for empty inspiration, the kind of thing that evidently many people need, and in a somewhat sad way, to help them try to improve their lives. And I don't think they're evil or ill-intended, but I think they often are sort of vacuous and not really helpful in the long run. You know what? It's like diet books. Why are there so many of them if they work?
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that, because I was thinking about your metaphor from much earlier in the show about the whole food movement, the slow food movement. It seems possible that those more synthetic conversations fill people's space that would ordinarily be filled with these conversations with strangers, in the same way that fast food crowds out our appetite for things that are good for us.
I think it's precisely right. And I think that it's funny because it becomes a political, in some ways, vaguely political issue. I have this argument with my son from time to time. It's the responsibility of people who purvey food to try to make it healthy, one would think. And it's the responsibility of people who purvey entertainment and culture to try to make it wholesome, one would think. But it's also the responsibility of the people who sit down at the table to decide for themselves that they're going to eat in a healthy fashion and demand to do so. And it's also the part of people who listen, read, and watch various media to demand that what they receive there has some value and substance. So it's a very tough question about, all the way from food to popular culture to serious culture, the balance between those who provide the material and those who consume it. And the consumers have responsibility, too.
Your son is an adult now?
Yes, he is. He's 26.
Do you remember a moment where suddenly you could talk to him in a really different way than you
I'll
had?
I'll tell you. I'm so glad you asked me that question. First of all, he kissed me on the cheek the other night, and I almost fell over. Because, you know, what happens is in adolescence, if it goes well, kids rebel. They have to, or they... And, you know, it's a parent's job to embarrass their children.
And it's kids' job to rebel.
And it's his job to rebel. And if it doesn't happen, it's not right. So when I got this little buff on the cheek after a particularly touching moment, I thought, this is great. He's coming back. And children do come back to their parents in the most graceful kinds of families. It doesn't happen often enough. But when it does, I hope it will continue to. In my case, but I realized that my son was an adult when he was beginning to be an adult when he was 4 years old. And I'll tell you why. My wife and I had a pretty bad argument. One of the things that we would do is, I think, take a time out, you know, even an adult time out. I got on the elevator in a New York City apartment house, and I took my son out, who was four, and we were going down the elevator, and I was sort of slouched over in the corner because we disagreed about, you know, some trivial thing about parking or when we were going to go to a movie or whatever dumb thing it was. But he looked at me and he said, out of nowhere, he said, it's hard what you do. And I said, sorry? And he said, it's hard what you do. I said, what do you mean? He said, be a dad. And I thought that was the beginning of a kind of empathy that, has developed off and on since then. And I think you get early, I mean, he was perceiving the way that I felt and responding to it and actually sympathizing with it. And it was all I do to resist saying, you're damn right.
Well, it's sort of an extraordinary gift that you had the wherewithal to notice that and to recognize it for what it was.
I think anybody would have noticed that in a four-year-old. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, it was as if he'd grown up 20 years or 30 years, and then he retreated to wanting an ice cream cone, yeah. You know, but that's fine. I forget what your question was. I'm sorry.
Oh, about the moment when suddenly you could speak to him as a true adult, not a really smart four-year-old.
Well, I guess I did begin to answer it, even unwittingly or by accident. I think what happens between parents and children is that if it goes well, if there isn't a real rupture, as I say, often happens. I mean, Freud says that great families fall apart gracefully. And I think that's a very interesting and complicated and dark sentence, but I think there's some truth in it. They don't really fall apart. What it means is that the children grow up and become adults and dependent on their own. They maintain a good relationship with their parents, and it's gratifying to both, but it's no longer parents and children. That's the main thing. And I think that that process is gradual. I think it's gradual in us as children. And I continue to mature in regard to my own parents, even though they're both departed now. But I begin to see more and more about them. So I think it's a developmental process. And in most cases, I think women, young women, begin to see their parents more as simply human beings at an earlier point. Boys, I think, take a little bit longer.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go next on the phones to Jeanette in Dallas. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi. I love this conversation, and I'm anxious to read the author's book. But I have something that's been nagging at me for quite some time, and this has to do with both people that I might be talking to at a party or people that aren't quite friends, but we're maybe on our way, we're getting to know each other. And I'll be talking, and I have a lot of stories from my past because, well, I was rather wild, as you put it mildly.
And we'll leave it at that.
We'll leave it at that, exactly. And so lots of times people respond to me and they go, oh, you should write a book. And I don't know whether to take that as, okay, it's time for you to shut up now, or to just take it as a compliment. I mean,
I think it depends. I mean, that's interesting. And first of all, let me defend writers for a second. Writers are not doctors. They don't go to 6 years of medical school and 8 years of residency and 12 years of internship or whatever it is. And they're not lawyers. They don't become associates and so on. But it is a profession of a very ragtag sort. And some people can just pick it up. And I do not mean to disparage the possibility of your writing a book. I mean, for all I know, you'll write a bestseller if you do it. But to address the conversational point, if someone says that, if you've been telling, shall we say, vivid stories about your past, I think what you need to do, I mean, what I would suggest you do is look at the expression on the face of the person who says you should write a book. If they look nonplussed and somewhat taken aback, I think that's a polite way of saying, I wonder if this has crossed the boundary that I wasn't quite ready to cross. If their expression is delighted and intrigued, then I think, you know, you've chosen your target well. A person wants to hear more and is suggesting that you have a colorful story to tell. So it as with many other simple sentences, I think it's a matter of context. And in this case, it proves that you need the other physical clues to have a real conversation because you need to be able to read body language and facial expression.
When you write in the section about being sort of trapped with someone that you may not adore talking to, you express the idea that it's really your responsibility to make it enjoyable for both you and for that other person.
Well, to hell with the other person. I mean, honestly, and they may find you boring. So it's not as if I'm saying automatically that you're right and they're wrong, or you're a great party guest and they're a bad party guest or anything like that. But I think to preserve your own sanity, first of all, you know, if it really is going badly, but if you are seated next to someone at a rather formal party and can't move, you have to throw yourself your own life preserver. And there are certain tricks, or at least delaying tactics, before boredom finally makes you put your head in your soup, you know, in sleep. And they are, you know, as described in the book, they seem very sort of, crude or easy, but they do tend to work. Top tens are good. If you're eating dinner, you may say, you know, I really, really like this, whatever it is. And what are your favorite foods? People are always ready to talk about it. And then you can get into whether it's certain recipe. I mean, you need to manufacture your own goods in a way. Top 10 movies, top 10 books, this and that, the other thing. We've already talked about people you don't talk to. Almost everyone has somebody like that. I think another way of doing it is say, so tell me what your day is like. Whether it's occupational or personal or social, people will at least give you 15 or 20 minutes if you need them to buy time about, you know, well, I get into my office and I do this and that, and you must make yourself interested. Sometimes it's just a jail sentence, and you have to do the time.
My grandmother used to say, offer it up for the poor souls in purgatory.
There you go.
Let's go. I think we have time for one more phone call, and this time we'll speak with Kevin in Burleson. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, Chris. Another great show.
Thank you.
Just want to ask him about the influence of music for transgender communication between male and female, old and young.
Well, I think that's an excellent question, and I think all sort of cultural artifacts are what I call thirds. They're not immediately about the state of your health, the state of my larynx, the state of anything personal. They're objects, whether they're paintings or movies or music, that are objective. They're not immediately part of, let's say it's a boy and a girl, a man and a woman. They're not part of their lives. What they do is they function as a focus for conversation and opinion giving and testing each other out and seeing if you're on the same page. And I think the specific question you ask about music is very important, because people who care about music, it's a very visceral matter and it's very personal. And I can tell you the two things that if someone is trying to form a relationship with someone, and if they have constant and decisive differences of opinion about two things, music and movies, it's not going to go well. it's just not going to go well in the long run. Books, not so much.
People, why do you think so?
I don't know. I think because music and movies have to do with really physical entities, you know, visual stimuli and auditory stimuli that are outside the self. But I think people give each other passes for the very, very personal, quiet exchange between an author and a reader and say, okay, that's your territory. I can disagree with you about this novel. I can disagree with you about this book about politics. But it seems to have less emotional impact than a movie or a piece of music, especially popular music. I mean, my kids both, they don't form their friendships on the basis of musical taste, but they certainly play a role.
I was going to ask you about the most natural way to end a conversation. Unfortunately, we have a very unnatural time deadline that we've run up against, so we'll have to end it here. Daniel Menaker is a writer and literary editor. His new book is called A Good Talk, The Story and Skill of Conversation. Dan, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a great pleasure to talk to you. I appreciate the generous time and attention you've given this book.
It was fun. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.